All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru Gauranga. All glories to
Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prasthaya Bhutale Sri Mati Bhakti Vedanta Swami Niti Ramana. Namaste Saraswati Devi Gauranga Pacharya Sisi Sinyari Kasi Vandeham Sri Guru, Sri Chakra, Sri Guru, Vaishnavam, Sri Rupam, Sadhu, Jatam, Sadhana, Ravana, Kandikam, Sam, Sajivam, Sadvaitam, Sadvadutam, Parijana, Sahita, Krishna, Chaitanya, Deva, Sri Radha, Krishna, Padam, Sadhana, Lalita, Sri Vishakam, Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 Om Namo.
So it's February 26, 2012, in Karlovac, Croatia. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Chapter 12, Birth of Emperor Parikshit, Text 2. Tasya janma mahabhudhe.
Tasya janma mahabhudhe.
Karmani cha mahatmanah.
Karmani cha mahatmanah.
Nidanam chayatai vasit.
Nidanam chayatai vasit.
Sapretya gatavanyata.
Sapretya gatavanyata.
Please chant.
Tasya janma mahabhudhe. Karmani cha mahatmanah.
Karmani cha mahatmanah.
Nidanam chayatai visat.
Nidanam chayatai visat.
Sapratyaga tavanyata.
Sapratyaga tavanyata.
Tasya janma mahabhudhe.
Tasya janma mahabhudhe.
Karmani cha mahatmanah.
Karmani cha mahatmanah.
Nidanam chayatai vasit.
Nidanam chayatai vasit.
Sapratyaga tavanyata.
Sapratyaga tavanyata. Ladies?
Tasya jama mahabhude.
Tasya jama mahabhude.
Karmani cha mahatmana.
Karmani cha mahatmana.
Nadanam chaya kaivasi.
Nadanam chaya kaivasi.
Sapretya gatavanyata.
Sapretya gatavanyata.
Tasya.
Tasya.
His of Maharaj Parikshit. Janma.
Janma.
Birth.
Birth.
Mahabhudhe.
Mahabhudhe.
Of great intelligence.
Great intelligence.
Karmani.
Karmani.
Activities.
Activities.
Cha.
Cha.
Also.
Also.
Maha Atmanaha.
Maha
Atmanaha. Of the great devotee.
Of the great devotee.
Nidhanam.
Nidhanam.
Demise.
Demise.
Cha.
Cha.
Also.
Also.
Yata.
Yata.
As it was.
As it was.
Eva.
Eva.
Of course.
Of course.
Asit.
Asit.
Happened.
Saha.
Saha.
He.
Precha.
Precha.
Destination after death.
Destination after death.
Gatavan.
Gatavan.
Achieved.
Achieved.
Yata.
Yata.
As it were.
As it were.
Translation and purport by Srila Prabhupada. How was the great emperor Parikshit, who is a highly intelligent and great devotee, born in that womb? How did his death take place, and what did he achieve after his death? Purport. The king of Hastinapur, now Delhi, used to be the emperor of the world, at least till the time of the son of Emperor Parikshit. Maharaja Parikshit was saved by the Lord in the womb of his mother, so he could certainly be saved from an untimely death due to the ill will of the son of a brahmana. Because the age of Kali began to act just after the assumption of power by Maharaj Parikshit, the first sign of misgivings was exhibited in the cursing of such a greatly intelligent and devoted king as Maharaj Parikshit. The king is the protector of the helpless citizens, and their welfare, peace, and prosperity depend on him. Unfortunately, by the instigation of the fallen age of Kali, an unfortunate Brahmana's son was employed to condemn the innocent Maharaja Parikshit, and so the king had to prepare himself for death within 7 days. Maharaja Parikshit is especially famous as one who is protected by Vishnu. Anyone know his name? One who is protected by Vishnu? Yes. And there was one child born early in ISKCON where there was some real danger at the time of her birth, and Prabhupada also named her Vishnurata. Maharaj Parikshit is especially famous as one who is protected by Vishnu, and when he was unduly cursed by a Brahmana's son, he could have invoked the mercy of the Lord to save him, but he did not want to because he was a pure devotee. A pure devotee never asked the Lord for any undue favor. Maharaj Parikshit knew that the curse of the Brahmana's son upon him was unjustified, as everyone else knew. But he did not want to counteract it because he knew also that the age of Kali had begun and that the first symptom of the age, namely degradation of the highly talented Brahmana community, had also begun. He did not want to interfere with the current of the time, but he prepared himself to meet death very cheerfully and very properly. Being fortunate, he got at least 7 days to prepare himself to meet death, and so he properly utilized the time in the association of Shukadev Goswami, the great saint and devotee of the Lord. Tasya janma mahabuddhe karmani cha mahatmanaha nirhanam cha yatai vasit sa pretya gatavanyata. How was the great Emperor Parikshit, who was a highly intelligent and great devotee, born in that womb? How did his death take place, and what did he achieve after death? So here Maharaj Parikshit does not want to counteract the curse of Sringi, although easily he could have done so, as Prabhupada says here. He was saved within the womb, why couldn't he be saved again? Why doesn't he ask to be saved? Prabhupada says here, because he was a pure devotee, and a pure devotee doesn't ask the Lord for any undue favor, any favor that's not due him. And it says he knew it was unfair. He knew he was innocent. I mean, obviously Maharaj Parikshit had done something wrong also. But it was not commensurate. What Maharaj Parikshit did to Shanaka Rishi and what Sringi did to Maharaj Parikshit were not commensurate. It was not fair.
What does it mean?
Fair. It's not equal. You know, if you call me a fool and I kill you, that's not an appropriate punishment. So Maharaj Parikshit putting the dead snake around Shanaka Rishi's neck, that was not proper. But to be cursed to die was not an appropriate response. Prabhupada says here that Maharaj Parikshit was innocent. In other words, he was innocent of being punished for in such a way. So you know it was unjustified. It wasn't just. But he didn't want to interfere, Prabhupada says, with the current of the time. He knew this is Kali's time. Kali has come, and this is how Kali's going to come. This is the will of the Lord. So I think that all of us have in our lives things that happen that we don't like. Right? Bhakti Vigyan Maharaj just gave a class in Mayapur about how only Krishna is always victorious. Everyone else gets defeated sometimes. Even the Pandavas get defeated sometimes. After Krishna leaves the planet, then Arjuna couldn't even string his bow anymore. He just had to take the bow like a stick and hitting the rascals over the head with his bow because he couldn't string it. And the Pandavas lost in the gambling match. So other than Krishna, all of us get defeated. In other words, our plans don't work out. We make plans, and we have this mood that whatever I plan is going to be successful. Right? We don't plan things, generally. I mean, maybe if you have some sort of psychological problem, but most people, whatever I plan fails. But most people, we think, yes, I'm planning this, and that's what's going to happen. Right? You buy a plane ticket or a train ticket, you figure you're going to get to your destination. In fact, you start making mental pictures and plans of what will happen when you achieve what you want, isn't it? And all of us, of course, want to live forever, because that's our natural state. Ajonichasasvatoyamparano. We're naturally unborn and deathless beings. But if we have to die, we'd like to die after a full life. Right? I mean, no one considers it a tragedy if a 97-year-old person dies peacefully in their bed of old age. But we do consider it a tragedy if a young person dies. We say, oh, they didn't get a chance to enjoy life. They didn't get a chance to get their plans done. So, you know, we have this projection of our life. We're thinking, this is how long I'm going to live, and this is what I'm going to do. And, you know, if we got a notice, if the doctor says to us, oh, by the way, you have stage 4 cancer, you know, and you'll be lucky to live more than a week. It happens. You know, it happens. One devotee's father in London, who was an elderly man, went to see the doctor about something, and the doctor said, you know, you'll be lucky to live for a month. He died 10 days later. Right? And then we have not just death, but little obstacles to our plans. Well, I make this plan, and this there's this obstacle. There's this reverses. There's this difficulty. So what do we do about them? Now, difficulty is especially hard when we feel that we're innocent. The famous writer C.S. Lewis, Christian writer, says that human beings can tolerate misfortune, but not when they think that the misfortune was taking away something they had a right to. If just something happens, you know, it rains and your trip is canceled, yeah, you can tolerate that. But especially if some other person does something to us that we feel we don't deserve. I'm innocent. Either I'm completely innocent, or maybe I did something wrong. Okay. I mean, I don't know if we ever really believe that. But at least we're trained by our society to say we did something wrong. Yes, okay, maybe I did something wrong, but what I did isn't so bad. And what this other person or persons are doing to me, it's terrible. What I did wrong a little bit, what this other person is doing to me is terrible. It's not fair. It's unjust. I have a right. I have a right to be treated in a certain way. I have a right to certain facilities. I have a right to get my physical, psychological, etc., social, emotional, intellectual needs met in a particular way. And if that doesn't happen, I'm going to do something about it. I'm going to fix it. Isn't that our general mentality? Of course, this is described in the 16th chapter as the mentality of the who has this mentality? The demons. The demons think, I have this plan. Someone's interfered with my plan. Therefore, I will kill him. And pretty soon I'll kill my other enemies too. Now, most of us, I hope none of us here has ever killed anyone. I hope. You never know, but life's funny. We've killed animals, all right. Probably not directly. Probably not. I'm sure that most of us here have killed a bug intentionally. Some bug was in our way and we killed it. This bug is interfering with my happiness. Let me kill it. So even if we don't go around killing others, we may try to kill them in another way. We may try to kill them psychologically. Let me tear them apart psychologically so that they're a little shaking mass of blubber on the floor. I'll never dare to interfere with my plans again. I may try to kill them socially. I may say bad things about them in my community. I may try to I'm trying to destroy their ability to interfere with my plans. So I have a particular plan. I want to be happy in this way. I want to achieve this, and something's getting in my way. If it's just circumstance, then I tolerate it. But if I see, wait a minute, this is not fair, and this person or this group of persons do it, then we usually try to counteract it, and we are not unwilling to counteract it in ways that are very harmful to the other party. In fact, we're not unwilling to counteract it in ways that may be much more extreme than whatever the other person's doing to us. So first I get offended that somebody is interfering with my plans when I'm really either not an offender at all or I'm a very small offender. And then I will retaliate against the other person or persons in a much more extreme way than what they did to me. That's the general behavior, at least in this Kali Yuga, of most of us. And here we find that Maharishi Parikshit is just not doing this. He's just saying, as Prabhupada explains at another point, he says that he saw this curse as the form of the Lord. He saw that Krishna had taken the form of this curse. And also, as Prabhupada says here, he didn't want to ask for anything undue, although he was innocent. He thought, it isn't due to me. I don't deserve it. I don't deserve to be free from this curse. And he didn't want to interfere with the current of the time. So he saw what's happening is Krishna's desire. Krishna wants the age of Kali to start. Just like there's seasons, and at a certain time it's winter. You know, the modern agribusiness, they try to prevent winter. You can go to the shops and you can buy the fruits and vegetables of summer, even in January. Although Ayurvedically, eating things that are locally grown and according to season is much better for your health. And that's considered the topmost in the fourth canto. It's described, I think, in relation to Dhruva Maharaj, that the topmost deity worship is to offer the Lord things that are locally grown and in season. So it's much more high class to offer Krishna pumpkins in January that you've kept in your root cellar than to be buying mangoes from another part of the world. So anyway, we find this, the modern demoniac agribusiness, they're not willing to let winter come. They're not willing to let the seasons flow naturally. And Hiranyakashipu was also like this. He forced the trees to bear in all seasons. Whereas Maharaj Parikshit is saying, it's time for the cosmic winter, and I need to get out of the way. All right, I would like to look at this and say, because I think we get very confused by this sort of purport and say, well, what do I do? When do I counteract? When do I not counteract? When do I pray to Krishna for relief? When do I not pray to Krishna for relief? What am I supposed to do? Again, most of us don't get cursed to die. I've met a few people who are convinced that they're the recipients of some sort of a curse. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. But I haven't met too many people who were cursed to die by another person. But I meet people all the time, including myself, who are the victims of unfair and unjust treatment by others, and who've had our plans foiled by unjust and unfair behavior of others. In fact, I don't know of anybody who hasn't had this experience, and I have this experience fairly regularly. It's not an odd occurrence. It's not something that's only happened, you know, once or twice in my life. It's not as if my plans generally are not only successful, but successful with the cooperation of everybody who I think should cooperate. It just hasn't happened like that. In fact, the people who interfere with my plans are often the very people who I think would benefit from my plans and who would want to cooperate with me. And I get very confused. So this, again, I found if you talk to almost anybody, you'll find that this is a regular occurrence. So what do we do? So I want to look at several different categories. First of all, categories where devotees personally counteracted some difficulty, where devotees counteracted a difficulty with help from other jivas, where a devotee counteracted a difficulty by asking for help from Krishna, and where devotees, like in this purport, simply accepted. All right, let's look at personal counteraction. Now, for the pure devotees, even when they're personally counteracting, they're always doing this with dependence on Krishna. The pure devotees are never acting independently. So I was thinking about when Krishna appeared as a little baby, and there was a big festival for his birth ceremony. It couldn't have been his one-year birth anniversary because he was very, very small. So I'm not sure if they were calculating 1 year from 9 months in the womb or if they were calculating the birth anniversary that happens every month when the moon goes back into your birth star. So anyway, they were having this festival. In Vrindavan, they have lots of festivals. Actually, it says in the Bhagavatam, third canto, that in the spiritual world, every day is a festival. Of course, if we think about that, we get tired. Every day, festival. But there, everything's play. Anyway, so they were having this festival, and Mother Yasoda was greeting so many guests, and baby Krishna fell asleep. And so she wanted to put him someplace where he would be protected, because there were a lot of people going around. So she put him in some sort of a little bed underneath a metal cart to shield him from the sun and protect him from people walking around. But he had fallen asleep without eating. And he woke up hungry and started to cry. And she couldn't hear him because there was so much noise with the festival and all the people that she didn't hear him crying. So he was not very happy that his mother wasn't feeding him. And he took his little tiny... So if you've seen a very small, small baby, their feet are only about this big. And their feet are so soft because they haven't walked on their feet. You know, they haven't used their feet for anything. And so their feet are so incredibly soft and delicate. And he just touched the wheel with his little foot and the whole thing collapsed. And all the metal utensils and the metal, it was a sturdy built cart. And it all collapsed, and it collapsed with a great noise. You know, all the metal utensils clanging everywhere. And somehow or other, he wasn't hurt. You know, if a cart collapsed on top of a baby, but he wasn't hurt. And of course, Mother Yasoda goes and gets Krishna and takes care of him. But the cowherd men, they put the cart back in order themselves. So here's a problem, and we're going to fix it. We don't have anything in the Bhagavatam, but they were praying to Lord Vishnu, or they fixed it. It fell apart. We're going to fix it. Okay? So they took things into their own hands, nor did they just sit there and go, I guess it's destiny that the cart is falling apart, and we're just going to sit here and look at all the utensils all over the ground. So they didn't do that. They didn't pray to Krishna. They did that, not that we know of. They didn't pray to a demigod. They just did it. Now, of course, they're all pure devotees, so they always have a mood of dependence on Krishna, but they did it. We find also that Arjuna, in the battle of Kurukshetra, there was one day when Arjuna was drawn away from the main battle, I believe, by the king of Susharma, and his son Abhimanyu was encircled by seven great warriors. And the Kshatriya codes is you have to fight between equals. You cannot get an unfair advantage. So this was unfair that seven people were surrounding Abhimanyu, all great fighters that could fight with 10,000 elephants. So that would have been okay if Abhimanyu could also have gotten help. If he could have called for great warriors on his side to help him, then that would be acceptable. But Jayadrath blocked the way and held off the other Pandavas, held off Abhimanyu's uncles, so they couldn't assist him in the battle. And Arjuna, interestingly enough, did not so much blame the Maharathis who attacked Abhimanyu. In fact, one of them, Kripacharya, later became the guru of Maharaj Pariksit. But he blamed Jayadrath. He said, Jayadrath, you have interfered with the proper dealings of warfare, and my son has been killed unfairly. And so Arjuna just took a vow. He said, I'm going to kill Jayadrath by sunset tomorrow, or I'm going to commit suicide. Which, of course, made all the Kurus very happy, because they thought, well, we don't have to kill Arjuna anymore, he'll kill himself. And we'll win the battle. So they were putting, the Kurus put all of their energy into protecting Jayadrath the next day. And of course, Krishna helped Arjuna. He certainly helped him very significantly. But Arjuna didn't go to Krishna first and say, Krishna, help me kill Jayadrath. He just said, okay, I'm going to deal with this. Of course, in that case, Krishna chastised him a little bit for that. He says, don't make these promises without asking me first. Okay, then we have instances of where devotees took help from someone other than Krishna. They didn't do it on their own, and they took help for someone other than Krishna. So we have the Brahmana in Dwarka, where his children all died after birth. Not only did they die after birth, but they went up into the sky. Pretty amazing. So first of all, this tells us that was a society where people didn't die young. That society was such, sometimes we think that if the whole society were Krishna conscious, it would be a society of poverty. Judging by the way some devotees think they're supposed to live. Why did we buy that land, Prabhu? Oh, because it was cheap. Why did you build the house like that so it's falling apart? Oh, because it was cheap. But in actually a Krishna conscious society, people were cared for. Hare Krishna. Just like Prabhupada says here in this purport, that the king is the protector of the helpless citizens and their welfare, peace, and prosperity depend on him. And although Prabhupada talks negatively about social welfare work as something that one does instead of Krishna consciousness or something that's done by the Brahmanas, social welfare work is the main duty of the king. It's the main duty of the government. So under a government like Maharaj Parikit, there was perfect social welfare work for everyone. So also with this Brahmana, he couldn't understand it, that all of his babies had died. I mean, no government today thinks they can do social welfare work to the extent that nobody will die untimely. They don't consider that they're responsible for that. And the Brahmana did not try to solve the situation himself, nor did he go to Krishna, but he went to the king, Ugrasena, and asked him to solve the problem. Of course, Ugrasena was not able to solve it. Yes?
Just a little bit. You said that I warn you if you will start to speak too fast.
Okay. Do I need to back up?
I'll manage, but just now.
You want to finish? I'll wait till you finish. Can you to catch up?
Last sentence.
The last sentence. Okay, so the Brahmana did not try to fix the situation himself, nor did he go to Krishna, but he went to Ugrasena. Of course, Krishna was the one who fixed it. It wasn't Ugrasena who fixed it. Then I was thinking about Bhagirath. So Bhagirath, by his own austerities, so one thing he did by himself, he called for the Ganga to come and for the Ganga to liberate the ashes of, I believe it was his great uncles. But the Ganga said, I'll come, but I'll fall down so forcefully that I may break the earth. So then Bhagirath did not try to deal with that himself, nor did he ask Krishna, but he went to Shiva. And he prayed to Shiva, you please solve the situation, which Shiva, of course, did. And we have instances of devotees praying to other demigods for their devotional service, like the gopis who pray to Katayani to marry Krishna, and Rukmini who prays to the goddess Durga also to marry Krishna. And I was thinking about who asked for help from Krishna. I thought about Draupadi. So Draupadi, she first tried, and this is very instructive, Draupadi first tried to counteract the situation herself. She appealed then to the other persons in the assembly, which included her husbands and her elderly members. And when none of them would help her, then she went to Krishna. And she asked Krishna to help her. But she didn't just stand there. Then Uttara, who of course is very connected with this story, When Asvatthama was sending the Brahmastra to her womb to kill Parikshit, she went to Krishna. She didn't just tolerate it. She went to Krishna and she said, "You can let the Brahmastra kill me if you want, but please save my child." Then Arjuna also, when Asvatthama threw the Brahmastra, Arjuna went to Krishna and said, "Krishna, you please help me. I don't know what to do. You know, give me the facility to counteract it." We have Bhima. Of course, this is a little slightly different because Bhima was told to kill Jarasandha by Krishna himself. So this was his specific service. It wasn't so much an obstacle in his personal life. But he fought with Jarasandha every day for 27 days, and he wasn't able to make any progress at all. And after 27 days, he went to Krishna. He said, "Nashaktoham Jarasandham nir jetam yudhi madhava. I don't have the shakti, Krishna. I can't do it." And then Krishna, "Abhyayam swena tejasa." Krishna gave Bhima his potency, and he told Bhima how to do it. Of course, the way he told Bhima how to do it was not in words. It wasn't explicit. It was a hint. He just took a blade of grass and went, shh. And then Bhima understood what to do. I also thought about Sudama Brahmana's wife. So when they were very poor and Sudama Brahmana didn't have enough to eat, that she rectified the situation by going to Krishna. Of course, she didn't go herself. She sent her husband. But she did go to Krishna. Then there are situations when the devotees just accept. Obviously, one of them is here, where Maharaj Parikshit just says, "It's the time for Kali. It's the will of the Lord. I'm not going to counteract it. And not only not counteract it, I'm going to use this situation to bring myself closer to Krishna. I'm going to use this for a good purpose." Maharaj Parikshit didn't think, "Well, I'm the protector of the citizens. I have such an important job to do. What will happen without me? I have to stay longer to do my service." He didn't think like that. He didn't think, "What about all of my plans? What about my family?" It's explained a little later in the Bhagavatam how Maharaj Parikshit's son, Janmanjaya, that he was devastated by the death of his father. And therefore he wanted to kill all the snakes in the world. So he got into this mentality of not only I'm going to counteract, but I'm going to counteract far beyond what's necessary. And then, of course, he was stopped by the great sages. But Maharaj Parikshit could have said, "My children are still young. My wife is still young. They need me. How can I die?" But he didn't. Another example is Maharaj Ambarish with Durvasa. I mean, talk about unfair. That's really unfair. I mean, Maharaj Parikshit actually did something wrong. But Ambarish didn't do anything wrong. Nothing at all. He had to break his fast. And he just drank a little water. I mean, he didn't commit any offense whatsoever to Durvasa Muni. And for drinking a little water, what was Durvasa Muni going to do? Kill him! Can you imagine? If some guest comes to your house and they say, you say, "Would you like something to eat?" And they say, "Oh, you know, I've been traveling for a long time. May I take a shower first?" You say, "Sure, here's the shower." And then you look at your calendar, because it's the day after Ekadasi, and you see that you only have one more minute to break your fast. And your guest is in the shower, and you don't want to eat before them, but you have to break your fast. So that's what happened. And imagine your guest comes out of the shower and tries to kill you. And what Durvasa said, I mean, he said, "You're not a devotee of Vishnu. You don't follow the principles of religion. You think you're God." I mean, that was all true about Durvasa, not about Ambarish. He was really talking about himself. So, you know, your guest starts insulting you and then tries to kill you, you know, what would you do? I would probably push them out the door. Call the police. And Maharaj Ambarish just stood there. Now, of course, Part of the consideration is that Maharaj Ambarish was acting as a kshatriya, Durvasa is a brahmana, and that Durvasa was his guest. So had this kind of behavior gone on the battlefield with another kshatriya, I'm sure that Maharaj Ambarish would have fought back. But seeing Durvasa as his guest and seeing him as a brahmana, he didn't do anything. He just stood there with his hands folded. Now, although Krishna saved him, Maharaj Ambarish did not ask to be saved. We have Judd Bharata. So Judd Bharata is after the death of his father and mother. He was raised by his stepmother. And, well, not raised, he was already grown up, but he was taken care of by his stepmother and 9 stepbrothers. And they gave him menial work to do. They fed him burnt food, worm-eaten food, you know, something that stuck to the bottom of the pot. If he went and earned something, they might even take his money from him and use it for themselves and give him something not very nice. And he never counteracted it. In fact, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains that Judd Bharata had so much mercy on his stepbrothers and stepmother that he felt that just by being there for a while, he was benedicting them by allowing them to see him as a self-realized soul. Then Judd Bharata was kidnapped by dacoits who were going to sacrifice him to the goddess Kali in their imagined ritual. And again, he didn't do anything to counteract it. Nothing. He didn't ask Krishna for help. He didn't take any action on his own. Nothing at all. He just simply, okay, I get to be sacrificed to the goddess Kali. All right. You know, and of course he was saved by Kali. I was thinking about Haridas. Haridas Thakur, just because he had, in the eyes of the local Muslim leader, converted from Islam to Hinduism. That's how the local Muslim leader interpreted the situation. So the local Muslim leader wanted to make an example of him. So he ordered that he'd be beaten in 23 marketplaces. You know, you would die after 5 or 6. And Haridas Thakur didn't protest, and he didn't make any effort to counteract the situation. He didn't pray to Mahaprabhu, nothing. Of course, Mahaprabhu later showed Haridas that all of the beatings had gone on the back of the Lord. Then Prahlad Maharaj also. So his father tries to poison him, throw him off a cliff, throw him under the feet of elephants, put him in boiling oil. I mean, if somebody tried to put me in boiling oil, I would try to get out of there. And that's what we teach our children. You know, Hiranyakashipu is the epitome of a child abuser. He's the Adi child abuser, the original universal child abuser. So, you know, what do we teach our children? We tell them, say, yell no, and run away and get help. Right? You have this little formula, you know, if somebody tries to abuse you, say no! And run away and get help. But Prahlad Maharaj didn't do that. All right, so what do we do? How do we know when to do what? How do we know when, you know, when do I just counteract it myself? When do I ask other people to help me? When do I ask Krishna to help me? And when do I just tolerate? So the one thing we don't ever want to do is get in the mood of the demons. And by the way, sometimes this happens even to devotees. If it happens to us, it's not so astonishing. It happened to Jnanmanjaya. Who else did it happen to? Great personality in the Bhagavatam. Dhruva. What did Dhruva do? Start killing all the yakshas. One yaksha killed his brother, and as the king, he should have found that one yaksha and punished him. And instead of doing that, he declared war on the whole race of yakshas and was killing innocent yakshas. And then Swayambhuva Manu had to come and say, stop this. You know, you've gone beyond the border. So if this happens to people like Jnanmanjaya and Dhruva, we shouldn't be so surprised that it happens to me. That if someone does something wrong to me or wrong to my family, wrong to my friends, that I feel is unjust, that to have this tendency to want to kill the other person in some way, not physically perhaps, but to try to kill them socially or politically or emotionally, psychologically, to try to neutralize them, get them out of my way. Of course, in the Kali Yuga, as mentioned in the Bhagavatam, that this sort of thing happens even between family members. I mean, of course, that was what Hiranyakashipu was thinking of Prahlad, although Prahlad was his little son. But this is now regularly happening in a family. You know, that the husband and wife are thinking, let me punish you for this, let me punish you for this, let me punish you for this. And it's like some battle of the demons going on in the family. Actually, I know one devotee who had an astrologer tell her, you and your husband died last life on the battlefield, killing each other. You know, and you're still doing it in this life. So, you know, this happens even in the relationships that are supposed to be the closest. Well, he said that, so now I'm going to say this. Oh, well, she said that, now I'm going to say this. You know, and going on and on and on and on and on. And it happens in our devotee family. It happens in our devotee family. You know, this devotee, they didn't treat me right. I gave 5 years to this temple, and then they told me I couldn't stay here anymore, and this happened, and that. Well, I'm going to get them. I'm going to write something nasty and put it on the internet and send it to all my friends. So at least we shouldn't do that kind of thing. Now, if we feel some inclination to do that kind of thing, we shouldn't be surprised. It happened even to Dhruva. But we should avoid it. We should not get into this. Let me neutralize my enemies. Now, Prahlad Maharaj said, thinking like that in terms of friends and enemies, this is the opposite of transcendental consciousness. And Krishna says, the yogi, they see pebble, stone, and gold as the same. Not that you use gold and pebbles for the same purpose, but you don't have attachment. And he says, similarly, the yogi views the friends, enemies, and the neutral all with an equal mind. Prabhupada says, one should think that this person has become my enemy due to the will of the Lord. So that aspect of what Maharaj Purkit is doing, we should always have. This, what's happening now, is the will of the Lord. Like the cart falling over, even though they fixed it, whose will was it that the cart fell? Krishna's. He wanted the cart to break apart. It doesn't mean they didn't need to put it back together. So the first thing the devotee sees is everything is the will of the Lord. Everything. There's nothing that can happen. Not a blade of grass can move without the sanction of the Lord. If someone's acting as my enemy, then that is sanctioned by Krishna. That's what we start with. We always start with that. Krishna has allowed this, even if it's something horrible. Even if it's something horrible. What happened to Haridas, what happened to Prahlad, was horrible. Beyond, probably, what any of us will experience in our life. I mean, we might. Right now we're trying to help one devotee who was beaten by the KGB for distributing Srila Prabhupada's books. And he was certainly beaten as severely as Haridas, etc. But for most of us, that's probably not going to be our life experience. In any case, if they can see like that, we should also see Krishna's doing this. Then our question becomes, how does Krishna want me to respond? That ultimately Krishna has set up this situation. You know, there's a funny story about Gaurakishore Das Babaji, that when some local children were throwing stones at him, that he said, I know who's doing this, and if you don't stop, I'm going to tell Mother Yasoda. So the devotee sees Krishna behind everything and sees that Krishna is arranging every situation to bring us closer to him. The so-called good and the so-called bad. You know, the materialists, they try to see the material good in material bad situations. All right, I miss my plane. that's a bad situation. But I got to meet an old friend of mine at the airport who I wouldn't have met otherwise. So the bad situation was actually a good situation. But that's not the way the devotee sees things. The devotee sees that everything is good. In 15:15, Prabhupada says, God is all good, God is all merciful. So everything is transcendentally good. Everything is meant to increase my loving relationship with Krishna. This is very difficult to do, but it's worth it. It's not easy. I'm not saying that this is easy. I can say it's easy right now, but when something happens to me, it's not easy anymore. But it's worth it. It's worth it to say, Krishna's doing this. Krishna's allowing this. Krishna's sanctioning this. Whatever it is, whether it's, you know, the body getting diseased or broken, whether it's other people causing one psychological pain, whether it's some difficulty in our plans, whatever it may be, a loss of finances, terrible weather. And that, all right, I'm Krishna's servant. What does Krishna expect of me? What kind of response does he want me to give? How can I give a response that will glorify Krishna and bring me closer to him? That's the main question to ask. Now, generally, not always, generally, counteracting strongly by attacking the other person is not our service. Sometimes. Just like when Srila Prabhupada was on the planet, there was a court case against the devotees accusing us of brainwashing. And Prabhupada wanted us to fight it in court. He didn't want us to just sit down and take it and just say, okay, you know, we're all brainwashers. So right now there's this court case in Russia about the Bhagavad Gita, and we won the first round, and now it's going to appeal. So we're not just going to say, all right, well, whatever you want to do. And we're going to deal with it strongly. But even when we have a strong response, it should never be from the place of, this is my plan, and this is what I'm due, and how dare anybody get in the way of my desires. That's never the mood of the devotee. Never. Even if we take strong action, it's only because this would please Krishna. No other reason. And for ourselves, like Krishna told Arjuna, fight for the sake of fighting without considering gain or loss, victory or defeat, honor and dishonor. But most of the time, we don't find that the devotees have these sort of external strong counteractions. They do something practical like putting the cart back together. And if it's something outside of the range of what they can do practically, but they see that they need help for their service, they go to Krishna and say, Krishna, help. Or when Indra was flooding Vrindavan, everyone went to Krishna for help. So it's very difficult to look at someone else's situation and say exactly what they should do. We cannot make a rule and say, okay, when you're in difficulty, you can't even ask Krishna. Or when you're in difficulty, you should ask Krishna. Because we see sometimes the great devotees ask Krishna for help, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes they take an immediate, obvious, practical step to fix things, and sometimes they don't. Sometimes they ask other living entities to help them, and sometimes they don't. But the mood is always, what will make Krishna happy? What will make Krishna happy? Now you can say, well, that just removes the problem one step, because how do I know it will make Krishna happy? Well, we know a few basic guidelines. What will make Krishna happy is if my actions bring me closer in love to him. If my way of solving a problem means that when I chant my japa, all I'm thinking about is the problem, that's not right. If my way of solving the problem makes me feel that, why did I get treated badly? That's not fair to me. I'm special. I'm important. I need to get this and that. That doesn't make Krishna. I mean, these kind of things we know. We know what makes Krishna happy. If I get more attached to him in love, if what I'm doing increases my joy, Ramabhutta Prasanatma. Prabhupada wrote a letter to Jadarani. He said, unless you're joyful, you can't make any advancement. If my way of counteracting the difficulties means that I'm disturbed, I have no joy, I've lost my connection with Krishna, I haven't thought of Krishna's beautiful lotus feet and flute playing because I'm so absorbed and I have to get this thing, that's not pleasing to Krishna. So first thing I'm going to look at is myself. My way of counteracting this difficulty, does it bring me closer to Krishna? And actually closer to Krishna. Not, well, it brings things more in line with the philosophy. I remember once in a meeting many years ago, when the devotee said, if we go on like this, we'll forget about the little blue boy playing his flute. And it was such a shocking statement to me at the time. I thought, oh yeah, the little blue boy playing his flute. Oh yeah. You know, you can be in the Hare Krishna movement for hours, or days, or weeks, or months, or years, and never think about the little blue boy playing his flute. It's possible. It is possible. You can be chanting Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, thinking, yeah, that guy is Krishna. Right? And where's Krishna? Where's Manmana Bhava Mad Bhakto? Oh, that's for later. I can't do that now. I'm not advanced enough. That's not bhakti, my friends. Bhakti is you try to think of Krishna now. Doesn't matter how fallen and polluted you are, you try to think of Krishna now. So we see, is my way of counteracting, is that going to make me think of Krishna more or think of Krishna less? Think of Krishna more means think of Krishna's name, Krishna's qualities, Krishna's form, Krishna's pastimes. That's what it means, thinking of Krishna. Then the next thing is, how is this going to affect other people? Is it going to bring other people to Krishna? Am I going to benefit others? So these people have done some unfair thing to me, and they've hurt me, and this, and I'm going to get them. Is that going to, and that'll help them be Krishna conscious? I consider, is it really going to help them be Krishna conscious? If it was done to you, would it help you be Krishna conscious? How did Maharaj Parikshit deal with this? Shanaka Rishi sent a message. Shanaka Rishi was so ashamed of what his son Sringi had done that he sent a message to Maharaj Parikshit informing him. He was too ashamed to come personally, but he thought the king should know, because Maharaj Parikshit didn't hear Sringi's curse. So he sent a message, by the way, my son has cursed you to die. And one reason Maharaj Parikshit didn't counteract it is he didn't want to make Shamakrishi feel bad. He thought, you know, man's already suffering enough from what his son did. Let's just leave it. We don't have to punish the son. We don't have to just let it go. And we find that Srila Prabhupada, you know, sometimes when his disciples did something wrong, am I getting too fast again?
No, I'm just a little bit tired, but I'm catching.
Okay. You want me to wait?
Huh?
You want me to wait?
No.
You became silent.
Yeah. If somebody else can change me.
If someone else can translate?
Then falling apart.
You're falling apart, okay. I once went to a program in Hungary where they had simultaneous translation, and in the morning it was really good. And by the afternoon, there would be long periods of silence. We had these headphones. It was something done by the Hungry Farm for an ecological conference. And it was, somehow they had the same translator all day. Simultaneous translation. I mean, it was very high tech. You had your headphones for your language and you plugged it in and little thing and you switched it to English. They had all different languages, but I mean, the first hour was fantastic, and as the day went on, it got less and less, and by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you'd get a couple sentences, and then nothing. It's thinking, I think the translator is tired. So if I'm going to counteract something with someone, to deal with that person in a way that person will fall in love with Krishna. And people generally are not going to get closer to Krishna by beating them over the head. It just doesn't usually have that effect. It doesn't have that effect on me, usually. I mean, there's been some times when people were very strong with me and it helped me in my Krishna consciousness, but generally it doesn't have that effect. If somebody's like really intensely attacking me, yeah, that's not something favorable for my Krishna consciousness. So to deal with others, this is a basic moral principle, deal with others the way you want to be dealt with. And Krishna says this in the Bhagavad Gita, one should understand others' happiness and distress like one's own. So this should be our main guide. Number one, whatever happens to me, Krishna is allowing. That doesn't mean that I shouldn't counteract it. Krishna is allowing everything to happen. But the first thing is that Krishna is behind it. It's not that anybody can do something opposed to Krishna. And then the next thing is, as Krishna's servant, what would be the most pleasing way to Krishna that I could respond? And we judge that by how will it affect my thinking of Krishna's name, form, qualities, pastimes. How will it affect the quality and quantity of my sadhana? How will it affect the quality and quantity of my reading, of my relationship with the devotees? And then I look at the other people involved. How can I deal with them so they're more likely to think of Krishna's name, form, qualities, and pastimes? So they're more likely to get absorbed in their hearing and chanting. So they're more likely to improve in their human relationships. And if we do that, then whatever external thing we do, whether we counteract it ourselves, whether we ask somebody else to do it, or whether we pray to Krishna, or whether we just accept it, it's not really so important. That's decided in the particular instance. And you cannot make a rule that devotees should always respond externally in a particular way. Often we think first in terms of the externals. All right, here's a problem. What do I do? What behavior do I do? But the behavior we do becomes clear once I figure out the internals. I was telling one devotee the other day, if you want to know which road to go on, first you have to clean your windshield on the car so you can see. And we may laugh at this, but you know, somehow most of the drivers in India haven't understood that windshields can be cleaned. It's very... Yeah, it's really funny, except when you're in the car, and then it's not quite so funny anymore. You know, it's foggy outside, and you think it's really, really foggy, only because there's fog on the glass. And you think, I don't know which way to go. And you have to tell these drivers, look, there's a button right there on the car. And if you, we just had to do this in Tirupati. You know, there's a button there on the car. And if you push this button, it will take off the steam on the window. And they don't want to do it, I think because they're afraid it's using petrol. And I told it's not. I said, the air conditioning uses petrol, but the heating is pulling heating from the engine. And it's not costing you anything. And so this man, I had to lean over to the front and turn it on myself. And then he would turn it off. And I would turn it on, and he would turn it off. And finally I told the devotee I was with, I said, you tell him to stop the car, and we're not going to go ahead until he turns this on. And then the back window was also fogged. And I said, I see wires in the glass. These wires are for cleaning the window. Tell him to turn that on. And then the driver said, it's broken. Okay. And I said, stop the car. So you can understand a little of my personality. So I said, stop the car. I got out of the car and I opened the front door and I said, here's the button for the back window. And I pressed it and it turned on and I said, it's not broken. And after we cleaned the windows, then figuring out where to go was very easy. The windows were so, you couldn't see anything. You know, you're in this car. And Indian roads are bad enough when you can see, you know, and if you can't see.
Then in Paramatma.
Yeah, it was nothing there, you know, just fog. So before we decide where to go and what to do, which path do I take? Do I take the path of taking care of it myself, asking someone else for help, asking Krishna, tolerating it? Which of these paths do I take? First, you got to clean your window. And we think, oh, that'll take so much time. Like these guys thinking it's going to cost them rupees to do it, and it doesn't. It's free. And they're thinking like that. Oh, it's too much trouble to clean the window. Or they just have some wet rag there. You've seen them do this? They have this wet, it's already completely wet, and they're just wiping the window. But there's already a little button. The car manufacturers are very intelligent, and they already put in a little button that cleans your window. So we already have a little button inside, built in, that cleans our window. Right? It's Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. And we go and we get our consciousness right. And we remind ourselves, everything is sanctioned by Krishna. I am Krishna's servant. What action in this circumstance would bring me closer to Krishna and bring other people closer to Krishna? And when you do that, then your window's clear, and then you can decide on your practical course of action. So, questions, comments? Yes,
Prabhupada. I have a question about this topic.
Okay.
It's difficult to phrase it. Maybe I take three sentences. I was reading.
That's not very long.
Not long. One. I was reading about Bhaktivinoda Thakur yesterday. That when he was in the court, he could, in 5 minutes, he could exactly decide who is guilty and who is innocent.
Okay.
So afterward, he became completely calm. There was nothing. There was not something eating him inside. You're not a good judge. Maybe you did a mistake judging. So when I read, I was thinking about myself, because sometimes people are gossiping. Devotees, they're gossiping about who is guilty or innocent, or, you know, about personal life. I found one devotee gossiping about my personal problems. So I asked her, but I have another part of the coin for you to hear. It would be good for you, you will become a better judge after hearing this part. And she said, no, I don't want to hear, I know everything. I know everything because I feel in my heart. So my question is how to deal with this kind of judges, gossipers.
Okay, well, it's the same thing. So when somebody is judging us unfairly, we think unfairly, may not be. But if somebody's judging us in a way that causes us pain and it's damaging our relationship in the community, first thing I think is Krishna is allowing this. Krishna is allowing this. Krishna is allowing people to say things about me that are not true, or to say things about me that are partially true. You know, people say things about Krishna that are not true. This isn't just our problem. Srila Prabhupada had to deal with this even from his godbrothers. What did he, this, that letter, what did he say? My godbrothers brought me only compression, repression, and oppression. You think, you know, my godbrothers, they're going to help me in my guru's mission. I mean, some of them helped him a little bit, but most of them didn't. And many of them just criticized him. When Krishna, when the Shamataka jewel was missing, so Krishna was called a murderer. He had nothing to do with it. He was called a murderer. So this happens. Fame and infamy. Of all the opulences, fame is the most shaky. Especially nowadays, with how fast people can communicate. Krishna is allowing this to happen to me. Who hasn't been defamed? God gets defamed. why should I expect that I'm never going to be defamed? Is there anybody here who's never been defamed? Okay. I could tell you my stories too. You know, we all have stories. And sometimes we're defamed for something good that we did. Sometimes you do something good and you're criticized for it. Amazing. Just like, how did that happen? I don't understand. So ultimately Krishna's doing it. Then what response does Krishna want me to have? Okay. What would help me come closer to him? Well, it says in the Bhagavatam that if you're defamed, you should meditate on the story of the Shyamantaka jewel. So let's do that. Very simple. It's right there in the Shastra. What do I do? Shastra says what to do. Read that story. So read it. So you do. You go to the Bhagavatam and you read the story. And you don't just read it. Okay, I read the story. You meditate on it. How did Krishna feel? What did he do? How ashamed Satyajit felt afterwards. And you meditate on the story. That will protect one from defamation. Another thing we can do is, why does this bother me so much? Why am I so disturbed when I'm defamed? Because I need community. I have a need for community. Why do I have a need for community? Because I come from Goloka Vrindavan, where there's a community. I have, you read Rupa Goswami's book, Radha Krishna Ganadesh Deepika. He describes the whole community of Goloka Vrindavan. We come from a community where everybody likes each other. I mean, there's some competition between Radharani and Chandravali, and you know, people make fun of Jatila. But it's all loving. There's no envy, there's no malice. That's where we come from, that's our home. And when these things happen in this world, I can remember I'm in a foreign environment. I'm a fish out of water. I come from a place where people don't defame each other. At least they don't, not enviously. I mean, the gopis sometimes defame each other to Krishna. But it's loving. It's like if you're with your good friends and you insult each other in a loving way, right? We've all done that with our good friends. So you can remind yourself, what I really want is Krishna. We're never going to have it in this world that everybody likes us. Forget it. It's not going to happen. You're not even going to get everybody in your devotee community to like you all the time. It won't happen. And you won't get everyone in ISKCON to like you. It's just never going to happen. Krishna can't even get all of his parts and parcels to like him all the time. So it's just not going to work. You're not going to get every follower of Mahaprabhu to like you. You're not going to get every human on the planet to like you. Even if you got every human on the planet to like you, the mosquitoes still wouldn't like you. Somebody wouldn't like you. Trying to make it so that everybody likes me and everybody has consideration for my feelings and everybody wants to hear my side of the story and everybody judges me fairly, forget it. That's not where we're going to satisfy our need for love and consideration and fairness and community. We can try life after life, and we do that. You really want somebody, this person, I mean, this woman, why do you care if she understands you or not? What's the matter?
Public opinion.
Well, whose opinion? I mean, we have great devotees who actually like Maharaj Rasabdev. He wandered like a madman. Everybody was, they were throwing things at him. They were throwing stool and urine at him, even. Not just nasty words. We should care, does Krishna like me? That's who we should care likes us. Does Krishna like me? If I have my investment, Prabhupada uses the word investment in the story of Kaliya, invest in Krishna. Invest my need. I have a spiritual need for love. And I have a spiritual need for community because that's where I come from. Give it to Krishna. Use it as an opportunity. Krishna, what I really want is you. You know what happened. And also, we may not be as innocent as we think we are, Hare Krishna. But you know what happened, Krishna. You're the one who's going to judge me. You're the one who's going to decide. My community is with you, even if everyone in the world hates me. One thing that's helped me in this regard is I've seen some members of the Hare Krishna movement who, rightly or wrongly, you might say rightly, that's another discussion, have been defamed. So I know of some members of our movement who have been publicly heavily criticized, maybe even justly so. Maybe, who can say whether they deserved it or not? That's, how do I know? And I've seen that they can still be Krishna conscious. So I had a very interesting experience seeing this one person. And he actually did something wrong. Whether he deserved the defamation he got is another question. But anyway, he did something wrong. He wasn't just innocent. He has friends. He has service. He has a place to live. He has food. And he's very happy in his Krishna consciousness. Now, there's a lot of people who don't like him. And there's some people who would like him probably to die. But he has friends and he has a service. And if ever I become disturbed when people defame me, I think about this one person. I think, it's all okay. Krishna still takes care of us. We really don't need to have this or that materially. You can meditate on the verses in the 12th chapter of the qualities of a devotee. Someone who's not affected by fame and infamy, honor and dishonor. Heat and cold, happiness and distress. Then how do I deal with the other people? Sometimes I can get the other people to hear my side of the story, and sometimes I can't. And even if they hear my side of the story, they may still have their own opinion. What to do? Can also remember some time when maybe has there been some time when I judged somebody wrongly? I mean, let's be honest about it. Have I ever decided that somebody was guilty who wasn't guilty? I have. I mean, that's just the truth. So to be compassionate to that person. Is that all right? Or you can try to fix it, but it may mean several lifetimes of trying to fix it. I mean, that's really what you have to look at. Do you really want to, if you try your whole lifetime to convince this person that actually you're right, and when you die and this person dies, they're still not convinced, then you may have to come back to convince them in the next life. We do this, by the way. We actually do that. Yes.
I have one question.
Yes.
I have actually two questions, but one is directly connected with the question, with the topic. And before that, I need one confirmation from you regarding the class. How I understand is that mostly you're speaking about internals and which kind of mood and attitude we should have when something happened.
Correct.
And you didn't speak so much about externals and about practical, because it's hard to. It's not like stereotype formula.
Correct.
Each situation is different, so it's not easy to give some stereotype like this and act over.
Correct. Although I did give,
like Guru Sadhu Shastra principle,
I gave 4 externals.
Mm.
So I didn't just say we can't think about the externals. I gave 4 externals. Does anybody remember what the 4 externals I gave was? I went through them several times. Anybody remember? Yes. You can do what?
We can counteract. We shouldn't do anything. We can come to Krishna, or we can come to some other person.
Right. Krishna. And I gave examples of pure devotees who did each of those.
Yeah. So how? And we should act mostly externally on the principle of Guru Sadhu Shastra.
In that situation.
Yes. That is my need for confirmation. From
okay. And not just Guru Sadhu Shastra in terms of a law. But Guru Sadhu Shastra in terms of the principle of what's going to connect me and others to Krishna. Because Rupa Goswami says all of the rules and regulations are servants of always remember Krishna, never forget him. So not just, okay, because if you just say Guru Sadhu and Shastra, you can find something for each of these four. And maybe there's others I didn't think of, I don't know. So you can find something in the Shastra that will justify each of those. So when I say it should be based on Guru Sadhu and Shastra, I'm not talking about that you can find a rule that would back up any of these external actions. I'm talking about the essence of Guru Sadhu Shastra, which is that I'm always going to remember Krishna with love.
Okay, so thank you. That's first. And my question is actually, for me sometimes, this person which you described is very, how to say, something very high for me. This person, like you said, he did something wrong, and you know, the society of devotee or someone, just, you know, everybody say he's guilty, but still he found the strength and he's happy and everything. For me, sometimes if I really understand that I do something wrong to devotees, and then I understand Krishna is not happy, then it's very hard to me that day to connect to Krishna, because I feel that, you know, so to be Krishna conscious, knowing that you do something which Krishna is not happy, then did they do chanting for me or do they anything?
Well, this devotee has tried to fix things. He didn't just say, oh well, and go on with his life. He has tried to fix things. Some people would say that he has fixed things. Some people would say he hasn't fixed things. Some people would say he can't possibly fix things because what he did was so terrible that it's not possible to be fixed. I'm not going to judge that.
Yeah.
I simply observe that somebody, because we were just talking specifically about defamation, there's other kinds of things, but that it's possible to be very severely defamed by the society of devotees and still be happy. And still be Krishna. It's entirely possible.
Yeah, understand this, but in connection with Krishna, for me, it's hard to change the day. If I know the other day I do something which is like hurt some devotee or do something and Krishna is not happy with me. So it's hard to take japa. I mean, I do that, but then chanting to Krishna and trying to be nice, but I know that he's not happy with my acting. So how to regarding to Krishna? Yeah?
Have you followed the Shastra to rectify it?
Yeah, trying to.
Okay, so what does the Shastra say to rectify?
You know, to come and try to say devotee sorry and everything.
Okay, first you ask for forgiveness.
Yeah.
Asking for forgiveness means that I actually try to connect in empathy with the other person. It's not like something that children do. You know, your child hits another child over the head with their toy fire truck. So you take the fire truck away. And then the child is crying. I want my fire truck back. I want my fire truck back. Well, you have to say sorry. Sorry. It's not like that. It's not that I ask forgiveness so I can be free of sin and I can go on with my chanting. But it's more what Krishna talks about in the sixth chapter, that you really try to understand the other person's happiness and distress. I mean, often when we offend someone else, we think the other person is unreasonable. That I really didn't do anything that wrong. We have a very difficult time understanding how somebody feels, especially if it's very different from how I would feel in that situation. So to really try to connect, that is not easy. Now, the majority of the time, if I actually connect with the other person, they will forgive. The majority of, not always, but the vast, like well over 90% of the time, if I actually connect. connect, if I actually try to understand how the other person feels. So as an example, I had somebody who was very upset with me. And the things that this person was upset with me about, I thought were good things that I did. Okay. I thought I did this good thing and this good thing and this good thing. Well, sometimes you know that it wasn't so good, but these things I actually thought were good things. And other people in the situation also thought they were good things. This one person thought that they were bad things and said, Urmila, you hurt me by doing these things. And I thought, well, everyone else who was there said that they were happy. And they even thanked me for doing that. This one person was angry with me. So my first reaction was, well, this person, there's something wrong with this person. I did a good thing. Other people say I did a good thing. This person has a problem. Okay. I'll just say I'm sorry. I'm really sorry. But I didn't mean it. There was no... There was nothing. There was no empathy. So for years, you know, the person, I'm really upset with you. So then I tried to do some empathy trick. Okay, let me look up in some book on psychology. What do they say to do? Because I have to work with this person. I can't just say, well, I'm going to forget about it. So then I said, well, I'm sure you were feeling like this, or maybe you felt like this. And still the person wasn't happy, because it still wasn't real. And so I finally asked this other devotee, I said, what do you want from me? And this devotee said, I want you to list exactly, I did this, and I did this, and I did this. Oh, that was so hard. Wow, was that hard. But I did it. I valued my relationship with this person enough that I decided I was going to do it. So I wrote a letter. I did this. I said this. I made this decision. And this is how you felt about it. And this is what happened in your life because of it. So most of the time, if we've offended somebody and it's still not settled, it's because we haven't really empathized. Most of the time. Now, some people... you just can't empathize with. I haven't met too many people like this, but I have met some. I've met some people who are just so angry. They breathe anger. You know, they're just, that's what they, that's their food. They eat anger for breakfast, lunch, and dinner, and that's how they live. I'm sure you've met some people like this. They're always angry at everybody. It's very hard to empathize with those people. I found that I can connect with those people briefly. You know, there'll be a brief something, and then it's gone. You know, it's just gone. I mean, I had one instance, I was giving class, and the purport talked about how devotees should love one another. So I was talking about it because it was in the purport. The temple president was cooking in the kitchen. He came into the class. He said, how dare you say that the devotees should love each other? He said, I'm really sorry, it's right here. And I went to talk to him later. And I said, look, Prabhu, I wasn't telling you you should love the devotees. Of course I was, actually.
It was a good prasadam after.
Yeah, it was good prasadam afterwards. I said, actually, Prabhu, I was saying the devotees should love you. And he started to cry. And he told me about everything he's been through and how he was defamed. How he had this problem in his marriage, and because of that the devotees defamed him, and how he wasn't allowed to come to the temple for so long, and all his suffering, and nobody really understood him, and how much he had dedicated to Prabhupada's mission. You know. And he was crying. Tough guy. And I thought, wow. And then it was over. And he went right back to where he was. So there are some people like that, that you know, they're offended with you, and you really make an effort, and it just doesn't stay. Either you can't reach them at all, they've got a wall, you know, this thick around them, and you just can't reach them. Or you reach them for a moment, and then it stops. So then what does Bhaktivinoda Thakura say? Then you have to serve the person. And after serving them, if they still don't forgive you, then you have to chant constantly. But you don't immediately, then you have to chant constantly. Because it's an offense to the holy name. Anytime you offend devotees, it's an offense to the holy name. So those are the three things. First, you try to ask for forgiveness, and real ask for forgiveness. Ask for forgiveness in a way that the other person is satisfied with. 90-95% of the time, that's possible. It can be done. Most people are reachable. And sometimes a person is just not reachable. Maybe you've offended them so badly that they're just not able to deal with it right now. Or maybe they're just the kind of person that is not reachable. Some people, they're just not. They have a big wall and alligators and an electric fence. And they live on the idea that other people have offended them. That's what keeps them going in life. And you're now one of the people who's offended them, and that's feeding them. And what can you do? And they're still Vaishnavas, but not that they're not Vaishnavas. So then you try to serve them, and if they're still not satisfied, then you just chant.
And is it possible, for example, you're a preacher, and I'm also doing different kind of service where I have interfaced with so many different devotees. So is it... should we do that always somebody, because of some small or bigger reason, will be affected and insulted? Should we always try with everybody to resolve problems, or sometimes?
No, I think some people we can just offend them and step on them, and that's all right. What do you think? I mean, think about what we're saying.
No, I mean, like, for example...
No, really think about what you're saying, and I've been there. I thought that way. It's really hard, you know. Yeah, when you're a leader... I mean, especially if you're dealing with thousands of people, some of them are going to be offended. And it's, you don't want to take the time. And you just think, oh, forget it. I don't know. I don't think it's a good idea.
I mean, sometimes you give a class, like 2,000 devotees who are in India, and you don't know, but somebody became...
Well, if you don't know, you don't know. What can you do?
Yeah, that's my question. If you don't know...
Oh, you don't know.
Because
you can't fix something you don't know. That's not possible. But if you know...
No, because like you said, there will be always that somebody will not love you.
But okay, all right. We're not trying to fix things to get people to love us.
Yeah.
We're trying to fix things so Krishna will be pleased, not to get people to love us. People may love us, people may not love us. Some people are not going to love us. Oh well. The whole world may not love us. Oh well, they killed Jesus. Some people didn't love him. How many people don't love Krishna? We're not... The motive for our fixing our offenses to others is not so everybody will love me. If that's our motive, then you're going to become bitter. And then you'll be one of those people with the big walls and the electric fences. And you'll decide, you know, forget about love. Stupid love. I hate love. You're supposed to love Krishna. And I'll be here, everybody should love Krishna. So that's not, don't look for material. You know, that's not what we're doing anything for. But if it comes to our notice that I've offended somebody, I should try to fix it because that person's dear to Krishna, because Krishna loves that person. Krishna doesn't want that person to be hurt. Whether they appreciate me or love me or not, oh well. But I have a duty as Krishna's servant. I'm in Krishna's business. It's my duty to make the customers happy. Whether the customers are happy or not doesn't pay my salary. My boss pays my salary. I'm not trying to please the customers, but I'm trying to make the customers happy to please my boss. And it sounds like the same thing, but it's not. It just isn't the same thing. Yes, my boss wants me to make the customers happy. But I'm not trying to get the love of my customers. Does this customer love me? That's weird. Hey, could you imagine going into a business where the guy on the other side of the counter cared whether or not you love them? I mean, that would be really weird. But they want you to be happy. Why? Otherwise, the business doesn't go on. So it's an occupational hazard of leadership. Especially now. Now, when I was a little girl, there was a funny comic I saw one devotee posted. You know, like in the 1950s, you have the teacher is sitting there like this, and the parents are yelling at the child, "Why are your grades bad?" And now, the child is like this, and the parents are yelling at the teacher, "Why is my child's grade bad?" There's no respect for authority in what's finished. It's finished. Even in the traditional cultures, even in China, even in India, respect for authority is becoming finished. Children respecting parents, a wife respecting her husband, the devotees respecting the temple authorities, the disciples respecting their gurus. You talk to some of the gurus in ISKCON and ask them, what do they go through with their disciples? You know, there's some sort of idea that if you're a guru, that people are just throwing money at you and doing whatever you say, you know, maybe for a few months. Oh, Hare Krishna. So as soon as you take a leadership position, you put one target on your forehead, you know, we're thinking of issuing these to all the leaders in ISKCON. So you can put a little place of your tilak, you put a little target. Then you get a t-shirt, has one target on the back and one target on the front. Please shoot me. It's really bad. I mean, it's not a little bad. It's really bad. And if you have any position of authority, then that means that you can be criticized. And how terrible if anybody would ever see what sacrifices you make. It won't happen. Maybe a few syncopants, you know, who want something from you. But generally, people, they won't see how you're sacrificing your money. They won't see how you sacrifice your house. They won't see how you sacrifice your health. They won't see how you sacrifice your time. All they'll see is when you did something wrong. And maybe they'll see when you did something that wasn't wrong, that this wrong. And they'll write letters about it, and they'll send the letters out to all your community, and they'll write to the GBC, and they'll put something on the internet, and that's what it means. And frankly, if you can't handle it, you shouldn't be a leader, because it's really bad. It's really, really, really bad. And one of the occupational hazards of being a leader right now is you can make this wall with the electric fence. So be careful. And I've seen even very wonderful and very sincere and wonderful devotees who, in a position of leadership, end up with a wall and an electric fence, where nobody can say anything negative to them anymore because they just can't handle it. And they don't make an effort to rectify how they've hurt others because they just can't deal with it. It's too much. So I think we have a responsibility, and I'm talking about me too, you know, we have a responsibility as a society of devotees to be kind to our leaders. To really, to treat our leaders with kindness. That doesn't mean we have to be fools, but and it's very, very hard to be a leader and remain a human being and soft-hearted without getting trampled to death. It's very, very, very difficult. I'd say it's a number one difficulty with having any leadership position in the world right now. Because bhakti is all about being soft-hearted. And if, in order to do our service, I have to harden my heart, I've lost the whole point. And how to do that? How to be a soft-hearted leader? I don't even have an answer to it. I just know you got to do it. And if you can't do it, then you got to change something. So if, as a leader, you're starting to notice that you say, well, I offended them, but oh well. Not everybody's going to like me anyway. What can be done? Let them be offended. I'm going to go on with my life. something's wrong. You know, as soon as we have to harden our heart and build a wall, something's really wrong. We're not, that's not an appropriate response. So how do we deal with it and stay sane? We have to be getting our needs met from Krishna. Got to be. I'm not saying it's easy. But it is worth it, and it's worth working towards it and not giving up.
I was thinking more like you said, you have this, your issue with this person for years, and then you valued your relationships, and then you do things.
Yes.
But what if you didn't value your relationship? Will that be wrong that you didn't do that or not?
I have to value my relationship with Krishna. I may not value my relationship with this jiva, but I value my relationship with Krishna. I'll tell you one last story, and then I'm going to stop. So I was... by the way, if you pray to Krishna to know who you've offended and to give you the opportunity to rectify it, you may be surprised what comes up. But it's very satisfying. So I do that periodically. I probably should do it daily, but anyway, I do it periodically. And I was really praying, you know, Krishna, if there's... I know I must be offending devotees because I'm not achieving what I want to achieve in bhakti. So the next day, as usually happens when you pray to Krishna like that, it's usually fairly fast that you get a response. So I was in another country, and some devotee I hadn't had contact with for 20 years found out I was in that country, found the phone number of where I was staying, and called me and said, "Urmila, I'm very angry at you for something you did 20 years ago." So I heard what she was angry at me about, and my first internal reaction was, "This is really stupid." She was angry at me because on her son's first day of school, when he went in the temple room, he went right up in front of the altar, and I went and took him and made him stand with the other children. And she said, from my doing that, her son doesn't want to be a devotee anymore, now that he's 25 years old. So my first reaction is, this is ridiculous. I thought I didn't say it, but I was, thank you, I didn't say it, but I was thinking it, and I was feeling it, and I was feeling, she doesn't know how hard it was for me as a Gurukul teacher. I was under a temple president who made me keep all the children in one area of the temple room, and would get very angry if the children were any other place. And so if I didn't strictly keep all the children there, I got in a lot of trouble. And she just doesn't understand that. So that was my first reaction. So I started talking to her, but my internal reaction was like that. And I said, I have to leave in 10 minutes. And she said, well, that's not enough time to settle this. So I was like, okay, first of all, it's a ridiculous thing. And second of all, 10 minutes isn't enough to settle this? It's a small thing. That's how I was feeling. Now, I hadn't seen this woman for 20 years. I never dealt with her. I had no interaction with her. For my practical life, what did it matter if I had a relationship with her or not? It didn't matter. No relevance. But very quickly, Super Soul reminded me, you were praying that you wanted to settle your offenses to devotees. Oh, yeah, I did pray like that. Okay. And I had this woman call you in answer to your prayer. Oh, yeah. And then I was glad that I couldn't finish talking to her that day. She said, I'll call you when you have more time. I said, how much time will it take? She said, maybe 2 hours. Whoa. But I was actually glad because I needed to work on it. So I started praying. I was like, Krishna, please show me what I did wrong because I don't understand what I did wrong. It doesn't make any sense to me. And I know you want me to help this devotee. And all I could figure out was that what I did wasn't wrong, but maybe the way I did it was wrong. Maybe I just wasn't sensitive enough. She said that her son, it was his first day of school, and he woke up about 2:30 or 3 in the morning, and he was so excited. I'm going to go to Gurukula. And the first thing that happens is, come on, stand back here. and it devastated him. So, you know, I had to try to think, what did I do wrong emotionally? And I don't know if she's happy with me or not, but at least I really feel that I did my best to please Krishna. And I ended up seeing her once or twice after that. But my point is, this is a situation where my relationship with the individual wasn't really very important to me. But my relationship with Krishna is important. And if somebody's thinking, you know, if somebody's angry with me for 20 years over something, at least I have to make an effort. And it did help me, you know, it made me think about, okay, it's not just what you do, it's how you do it. Do you really stop and try to think about how is the other person going to experience my behavior emotionally? Not just, am I right? Because I was right. I didn't do anything wrong. In fact, I did what I was supposed to do. But I must have not done it in a way that showed caring. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So yeah, we value our relationship with Krishna. It's important. My relationship with Krishna is important enough. Then I'm not going to say, for the sake of my service, I'm going to step on devotees. What's your service, Prabhu? Oh, stepping on devotees. I mean, maybe sometimes. That happened to Vitrasura. Vitrasura had a service to step on devotees. That was his service.
He was really good.
And he was good at it too, yeah. He did his service very well. That was his service. So, okay, if you really want that to be your service, we have to think. Like Mahaprabhu, I was just reading how Mahaprabhu gave one devotee a service. You just recite Bhagavatam constantly, because he was so pleased with his Bhagavatam recital. So, you know what I mean? You recite the Bhagavatam, you worship the Ganga, you chant japa, you worship the deity, and you step on the devotees. So unless you know you've received a direct order from Guru and Krishna that your service is to step on the devotees, then probably we need to get whatever we need to get done in such a way that our thinking of Krishna and everyone else's thinking of Krishna is enhanced. What do they say? A Vaishnava is one. How does Mahaprabhu define a Vaishnava? Just by seeing the person, I remember Krishna. Like Vishnu Chakravarti Thakur said, that Judd Bharat was benedicting his family and the dacoits by just letting them see him. So as soon as someone sees us, then they should remember Krishna's name, form, quality, and pastimes. What to speak of by our actions. Okay, so I've gone way over time. I'm so sorry. Thank you very much. Oh, glory to God.